to move on to today's topic, we're going to be talking about narcissistic pathology. Now, there's an overlap with borderline, and I'll try to explain. It's often a topic that people are quite interested in, but I do want to also give credit to my colleagues, Diana Diamond, Barry Stern, and Otto Kernberg, who, along with others, we've been working together to try and further understand what goes on with our narcissistic patients. If you have the handout, and if you have called in and don't have the handout, you can email and get it. There are some references with readings, but I'll skip over those and get to the first slide with information on it. So looking at the first slide, the International Personality Disorder Exam criteria for narcissistic personality disorder include mostly things that have to do with grandiosity, grandiose sense of self-importance, fantasies of success and power, belief that one is special, requiring excessive admiration, sense of entitlement, being interpersonally exploitative, lacking empathy, being envious, and being arrogant and haughty. Like the DSM, the IPDE requires a certain number of these to make the diagnosis. But I'm going over these right at the beginning to make the point that they partly describe narcissistic personality disorder as we understand it, but they leave out an underlying sense of fragility and weakness that I think is at the core of the disorder. Now we'll move on to the next slide. Narcissistic personality disorder and borderline personality disorder, how are they related? Briefly, the way I see it, they both have very much at their core an identity disturbance. However, they differ in that borderline personality disorder has identity fragmentation or identity diffusion, where the person's sense of self is changing pretty rapidly according to trigger events and according to the context the person is in. So they can just be all over the map in terms of how they're feeling. Whereas narcissistic individuals tend to be a little bit more stuck in one place, which is what we call the pathological grandiose self. Narcissistic people or people with narcissistic pathology, I'll get in a minute to the fact that luckily for us there can be a healthy narcissism, but people with narcissistic pathology tend to put together a sense of self that involves everything that's ideal and good, and they try to exclude anything that's negative and sort of project it onto the outside world. We see this pathological grandiose self as a compensatory sense of self is actually superimposed on a fragmented and weak sense of self that's defended against by this grandiosity. I'll get into that more later. Now, if we move on to the next slide, I just want to explain before going into the pathology of narcissism how the term itself can be confusing because it has multiple meanings. In the literature, narcissism can mean developmental phases. There's a primary narcissism and a secondary narcissism. I won't go into that now for lack of time. But it's also very much related to self-esteem and how to manage self-esteem, which is a challenge for each one of us human beings. In addition to that, it is a description of the state of and quality of an individual's relationships with other people. So I'm going to try to touch on those issues, self-esteem and the quality of interpersonal relationships. Now, going on to the next slide, maintaining self-esteem, I call this an internal affair because it's all about what goes on in one's mind, how one evaluates oneself. And we're doing this all the time, although mostly unconsciously. So one way to look at this is every individual in the course of their development develops what, at least in a psychoanalytic model, we call the ego ideal. The ego ideal is the sense of what we would be if we were everything we thought we should be. Now, for most people, we hold this as something we aspire to, but we can live without actually being that. The problem with a narcissistic individual is they can't feel good about themselves unless they are their ideal. They're their ideal or they're nothing. So if they don't meet the ideal, they're left with a sense of self-loathing and self-hatred, which is very common in our patients and in our friends and family members with PPD. Moving to the next slide about self-esteem, I'm going to say how this is related to what we call internal object relations, which means an internal sense of oneself and internal images of others. Because the gap between the ideal and the real sense of self could be in relation to one's own internal self-representations. In other words, the individual might think, I'd be happy with myself, I'd accept myself if I could or be X, Y, or Z, whatever they think the right things would be. And the flip side of this coin is I loathe myself because I don't meet up to that. So one individual might be comparing themselves to, in their mind, to what they think is right or best. But you might also, or a person might also, be comparing themselves to what internal object representations might be demanding of them. And this person might think, I'd be happy with or accept myself if I lived up to what this or that other person expected of me, what they wanted of me, what they thought I should be. Given this idea that a lot of self-esteem has to do with comparing oneself to internal images, it's very important to have realistic internal images of what's possible, who one is, and what the demands of others are in reality versus sometimes exaggerated sense of that that one has in one's mind. Now, turning to the next slide, this is called another psychological issue at play, and I think this has to do with self-esteem and self-acceptance, and here I'm going to talk about the way one experiences and expresses one's own aggression in a healthy way. And I'm also going to say that aggression has an impact on interpersonal relationships. And I'm going to explain to you why I'm talking about aggression in the first place. The reason I'm talking about it in the first place is the way I see human development. Everybody has certain aggressive drives to contend with. It's just part of evolution. The human race had to have some aggression to survive in the world. And one of Freud's most interesting works is called Civilization and Its Discontents. And its basic thesis is that civilization advanced more rapidly than man's biology and brain biology could advance. So we're left with drives, both aggressive and sexual and loving drives, that we can't express without some containment. So in order to feel good about yourself, you have to both satisfy these drives adequately, but contain them adequately so you don't get into trouble, either into trouble with others or with how you feel about yourself. So aggression is actually, the way we see it, a potential source of energy, achievement, and ambition. It doesn't have to be an aggressive type of energy, but it's force that has to be balanced and modulated in with the rest of the biological forces within the brain. And how one manages that does have to do with how good or bad one feels about oneself. So moving to the next slide, I would argue that self-acceptance includes integrating one's aggressive feelings in a healthy way and managing the impact of aggression on object relations. Now, by this latter, it makes me think of the title of Otto Kernberg's latest book, which is The Inseparable Nature of Love and Aggression. And this might sound a bit pessimistic, but it seems to me that every in-depth relationship has some aggressive as well as loving components. We have to know how to get through the difficult moments with the ones we love as well as the happy moments. So all that has to be integrated into a healthy whole. Not necessarily easy to do. So moving on to the next slide, given this overview of what I think the main elements are in a well-balanced self-esteem picture, the next slide is entitled, What is Healthy Narcissism? As I said before, it's nice for all of us that there is a healthy version of narcissism. And that is appreciating oneself with positive regard and with loving feelings towards oneself. This involves accurate appraisal of one's success, one's creativity, one's accomplishment, one's ambition, one's potential. It's very important to have a realistic sense of one's potential, not to aim too high, not to aim too low. We probably all know people who are extremely high achievers in the world and feel terrible about themselves because their sense of their potential is a little out of line with reality. They might expect too much. On the other hand, we know people with very modest potential who might be very content because they have an accurate assessment of what their abilities are in the world. They might accept themselves as such. So healthy narcissism involves that accurate appraisal. It involves satisfactory interpersonal relationships with friends and family. And it involves the ability to satisfy one's desires, one's needs. As I said before, we all have desires and needs that have to be contained because of social constraints and the mutuality of relationships. And the trick is not to inhibit ourselves so much that our needs are frustrated, but not to give in to our needs and our desires so spontaneously that we get into trouble with other people. So there's a balance to be achieved. Finally, healthy narcissism involves the ability to live in accord with one's own moral values and principles, because a great part of feeling good about oneself is living up to one's standards, and hopefully in the course of development one has internalized an integrated and harmonious sense of moral values. All right, let's move on to the next slide. What is it that we call infantile narcissism? Infantile narcissism is an unhealthy form of narcissism, but it's not yet what I'm going to call pathological narcissism or narcissistic personality disorder per se. Infantile narcissism is a stage that everyone passes through sort of appropriately as an infant, and it's based on the gratification and satisfaction of needs as they're experienced, including the need to connect, the need to engage with others. Of course, the trick is, in the course of development, one hopefully becomes a little more independent, a little more able to defer the satisfaction of needs, to tolerate frustration, and so on and so forth, and to enter into a mutuality in relationships. However, certain adults demonstrate an infantile narcissism, which is characterized by an insatiable neediness. They just need, need, need. They tend not to give so much. There's an incessant demandingness of others. However, in contrast to someone who has the more pathological form of narcissism, they relate to others in a form where the other does tend to exist as an independent being and on whom they can experience some dependency. As you'll see when we turn to the next form of narcissism, dependency is very difficult, and others are there more as a means to an end than to appreciate as separate other individuals. But before moving on from infantile narcissism is sometimes, perhaps even often, a characteristic found in people with borderline personality disorder, so it's something one can experience in the borderline range. But let's move on to pathological narcissism in the next slide, or narcissistic personality disorder. I'm just going to take a sip of water. Now, this is the way we see it, and I'll try to translate the lingo so it's comprehensible. A libidinal investing of a pathological self-structure. That means that one's loving feelings, one's attachment feelings, one's affiliative feelings just sort of ricochet back to the self and don't involve and don't loop in other people in the way that is more appropriate in a mutual relationship. The individual sense of self is organized around this pathological grandiose self I mentioned before, which is all about an ideal representation of the self. Anything negative, anything imperfect is projected to the outside world and seen as external to the individual. Therefore, these individuals lack a sense of a realistic integrated self, sort of a nuanced self that includes positive and negative characteristics all harmoniously living together. And it therefore tends to exaggerate and aggrandize the self and devalue others. And it excludes the possibility of engaging in relations at a deep level. There's a chronic devaluing of others. The person tends to feel, I don't need anyone. I have, I am everything I need. There's in a way a phobia of dependency. Dependency makes these people very nervous because it implies they don't have everything they need just in and of themselves. So, moving on to the next slide, this pathological narcissism involves a denial of dependency and a refuge into a sense of omnipotence, of not needing others. Now, clinically, since it does help to picture real individuals, these people who feel they are omnipotent and don't need others, as they move on in their years in life, tend to isolate from the real world. Many are almost hermit-like in their existence because simple contact with other people can be a reminder that their grandiose image of themselves isn't so accurate and isn't so real. So simple daily life interaction can be a challenge to the grandiose view. So often what you see in the course of their lives is this increased isolation, and it's a very sad situation. Also clinically, you see intense envy. Since underneath the sense of grandiosity and perfection, there's a hidden and lingering feeling of not being a full-bodied person and a kind of emptiness, just the perception, the seeing around oneself of people who are more together creates a sense of envy, and the envy can be very intense and very damaging to relationships. So unfortunately for these people, instead of looking for love, which is something that doesn't seem so much a part of their world, they seek endlessly to be admired. They try to do what it takes to get others to admire and look up to them, which isn't really the same thing as being loved. And the other side of that coin is a great fear of being humiliated, of having any flaw be made apparent. Any flaw to them would mean total humiliation instead of just realistically an example of the fact that nobody's perfect. And as I said earlier, people with this kind of narcissistic pathology tend to use others as ends to a means rather than to engage in mutually satisfying relationships. Now, if we move on to the next slide, that slide is called the two sides of narcissism, thick-skinned versus thin-skinned. I want to emphasize that what I've been talking about is really a more complex phenomenon than I can describe in an hour here. And you're probably thinking as you're listening to me, well, I know somebody who kind of fits that picture, but in a way they don't fit that picture. And I think one way to understand some of the variation in narcissism is you've got the thick-skinned people whose defensive system is really intact. And they can go through life and just sort of fend off any challenge to their grandiosity and go on with a sort of kind of an armor that leaves them feeling great about themselves in spite of what might be ample evidence that questions that. Those are thick-skinned narcissists. They tend to come to treatment less than the skinned thinned ones, or they come to treatment later on in life when their ability to hold up their defensive system is breaking down because there's just no evidence in, say, their 40s or 50s that the world is responding to them with the admiration that they're due. Thin-skinned narcissists are those people who have a grandiose sense of self, but all it takes is to look at them the wrong way, and the grandiosity begins to crumble. So there's a big difference in the strength of this structure we call the pathological grandiose self. As you can imagine, the thin-skinned narcissists are the ones who come to treatment earlier on in life because they tend to be more fragile, their defensive system breaks down more quickly, and they are more prone to depressive episodes. I also want to mention something about diagnosis. It's very important for clinicians and for everybody involved to realize that people with narcissistic problems often, in fact, most often, don't come to a therapist saying, you know, I'd like help for my narcissistic problem. People come because of symptoms. And in my experience as a therapist, the most common symptom is depression. And sometimes the depression that narcissistic patients present to the therapist is a very powerful depression. It's like their whole world is falling apart. There's a hopelessness. There's a bleakness. And at times, this presentation is confused if the diagnostic evaluation isn't carried out fully enough. This diagnostic impression is confused with a biological depressive episode. So I've seen people go for years getting biological treatments for depression when underlying it is a narcissistic personality that needs to be addressed more therapeutically. Even though the American Psychiatric Association hasn't issued treatment guidelines for narcissistic personality as it has for borderline personality, I think it would probably say for narcissism, as it did for BPD, that psychotherapy is the treatment of choice. Other things, including medication, might be adjunctive. But if you make the diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder, I think that therapy should be the focal treatment. And it is unfortunate to see a lot of people going through years of treatment for depressive disorder when it's a more complicated phenomenon underneath that. So I wanted to elaborate a little bit on a diagnostic system for narcissism within borderline personality organization. That's the next slide. Now, in a diagnostic system that's not exactly an alternative to the DSM system, but I'd say complementary to the DSM system, you can look at personality disorders in terms of the psychological structure of the individual, how well or not well they're put together psychologically. And the main characteristics of a borderline personality organization would be identity diffusion or unclear, not fully coherent sense of self. Corresponding to that, very different views of others, including the same other person in their life who might come across to the individual differently at different points of time, depending on exactly the interaction. What we call primitive defense mechanisms, putting that in the most simple terms, is seeing things in black and white rather than seeing the nuanced gray areas. And having variable reality testing, which means that under stress, there can be some distortions in the sense of self and other. Now, those are the characteristics that in our system we see apply to anyone with borderline personality organization. Within that broad category of borderline organization, somebody would be considered to have narcissistic personality if they had a facsimile of an integration of the self around the grandiose self. And if the variability in reality testing tended in the direction of a sense of grandeur of the self and a chronic and consistent devaluing of others, even when the evidence didn't point so much in that direction. Now, to talk about the clinical manifestations of this general level of personality organization we call borderline, there's nonspecific ego weakness, which means poor impulse control and lack of anxiety tolerance, unstable and disturbed interpersonal relationships. I'm going through these to see if people can relate it to whoever they're thinking about as they're listening to this talk. As I said earlier, narcissists tend to reject dependency and tend to eliminate deep, meaningful relations with others. There often is a lack of deep engagement in work and love life, and severe narcissism, the involvement with others tends to be to exploit others to get what they want from them, and at the most severe end of the spectrum to engage in antisocial or criminal acts, because the narcissist, given their sense of grandiosity, may feel they're above rules and above the law. The laws are for those little people out there, not for the grandiose self. And another area in which personality pathology affects the person's living of their life is in sexual life. There, in our studies, have been one group of people of borderline organization who had a total inhibition and had zero sex life, and another group that had a very chaotic and promiscuous sex life. Moving on to the next slide, this broad category of borderline organization also involves some pathology in moral functioning. There again, you can get a whole range. Some people are too hard on themselves. They're totally strict and sort of puritanical and totally scrupulous, so they don't let themselves get away with anything, and that's unrealistic and doesn't allow for the flexibility of going through life. On the other hand, some people are totally lax. These are the people I mentioned a minute ago who are above the rules. And some people are very uneven. They are very strict at one point in time and very lax at another, so it can be quite confusing to themselves and to the other people in their lives. The next item listed is a rather interesting one called the destruction of time, which is something we find in a lot of our narcissistic patients. By the time they get to their middle years in life, they don't have a sense of having an accumulation of a life. They feel like they're always living in the present. They don't understand people whose current life seems to be enriched by a full appreciation of an accumulation of experience. There's something about the way these people go through lives. They don't have a fully coherent sense of self and others, that they're sense of self in others doesn't snowball the way it does for the average individual. It doesn't grow as one passes through time. It sort of is whatever it is in the moment. And it can be very sad, depressing, and lonesome and lonely to have that sense of not having accumulation of experience over time. Now, in terms of working with these patients, it can be difficult for the therapist to engage them in the work because the defenses can be very fragile. Also, because the patient's reaction to the therapist can be a very devaluing one, and therapists have to really be on the lookout for this. If you're prepared for it, it's fine. You take it in stride. But I'll give you just a simple example of how careful the therapist and maybe other individuals in the patient's life have to be. I was just beginning therapy with a patient with narcissistic personality, and she was in about 50, I would say, and she hadn't really got anywhere career-wise, and she didn't really have any social network, and she had been treated for quite some time for depression. And it seemed to me she had this narcissistic personality disorder we're talking about. So as part of the evaluation, I was investigating her work life, and she wasn't employed at the time, but said she was working toward that. And I thought that was terrific because, as you probably all know, being engaged in some kind of productive activity, whether it's work, study, or volunteer work, is very therapeutic and part of the therapeutic process. In any case, I asked the woman about what she was doing, and she said she was going through a series of interviews at this major corporation, and, you know, this discussion extended over a few sessions over, say, a week and a half. And she was going on from one interview to an interview with somebody higher up in the company. And just in my own mind, I had imagined she was going for some kind of a management position. So when she finally got the job, she came into the session and said, you know, I got the job. And I said, well, that's terrific. What is it exactly you do? And this is where it got dicey. And I learned from it. I learned, you know, I wasn't tactful enough at the time. So she said, I report to my office every morning. I sit in my office with other people, and we pick up the phone, and we phone potential clients, and we try to sell them our product. And I was a little surprised because it sounded like she was doing telemarketing when somehow, in function with her grandiose view of herself, she tried to give me, I don't think there's anything wrong with doing telemarketing, but it was such a gap between that and the reality of the situation that in surprise I just simply said, oh, you're a telemarketer, just putting it in plain English. But that's what I mean when I say a simple element of reality can shatter the grandiose sense of self. She got very offended that I used the word and questioned my ability to speak English properly and dropped out of therapy. And I felt very bad about that because if I had it to do over again, I would have kept that to myself, would have said, here's a person who isn't ready to sort of face the reality that what she's doing isn't at the level of what she thinks she's doing or would like to think she's doing or would like others to think she's doing, and we can work within that, and we can kind of keep it vague for a while. Anyway, that's just an example of how engaging with these people, either as a therapist or as an individual in their lives, can be tricky. So moving on, and we've sort of begun to move on to treatment issues, I'm going to just remind people, and for some of you, might not be a reminder since I never know exactly who I'm talking to with these phone conferences, which is part of the interest of them. I'm talking about a therapy that's derived from psychoanalytic psychotherapy called transference-focused psychotherapy, where, as I said earlier, we see the main problem as a fragmented sense of self and others. So we see the individual as experiencing himself or herself and the other person involved in the interaction as based on some small element of the interaction that determines their whole sense of who they are. I can think of probably the best example I can give is when a number of us, Perry Hoff and I, used to work in the hospital together, and we'd have patients on the borderline unit. And almost inevitably, a patient would come into a session and say, I can't stand it here. This, Susie, another patient on the unit, hates me. And he'd say, well, okay, how'd you get there that Susie hates you? Well, I was going down the hall, and I looked at her, kind of mumbled hello, and she didn't say anything back. Now, the trigger event, of course, could mean that Susie hated the patient, or could mean that Susie was preoccupied with somebody, with something else in her mind, or with somebody else, or it could be that the patient, being very insecure, mumbled it so that Susie didn't hear it. But this is just a simple example of how a trigger event sort of provokes an internal reaction that floods the whole situation. That's what we see as a big part of the problem with personality disorders. The experience that one is having in the moment just takes over, and all the rest of experience, instead of existing as a solid foundation on which to stand and by which to judge one's immediate interaction, is just lost. So with a narcissistic person, we'll move on to the next slide, the pathological grandiose self, the most typical way of experiencing self and other is a grandiose self and a depreciated or devalued other. And the affect, the feeling that ties these two together is some combination of scorn or contempt or derision from the individual to the other person. Now, what does this do psychologically? Why would somebody sort of approach the world with this generalized stance? Moving on to the next slide, this pathological grandiose self wards off a self-experience of being inferior, of experiencing hatred and aggression that one doesn't know what to do with, of experiencing envy or rejection or humiliation or incompetence. So as I said before, it's a defensive structure. Now, being a defensive structure, it can fail. And that's where we move on to the next slide. The next slide is called the oscillation of the narcissistic object-relation dyad. This is when you get into the confusing situation of who's who. In other words, that relationship based on a grandiose self and a devalued other can flip or reverse so that in a split second, a person who's narcissistic and grandiose can feel like the tables were turned, as my patient did, and feel like, because I used the word telemarketer, that I'm this judge who's sort of sitting up on some high chair looking down and considering her an unworthy person, whereas that wasn't what I was feeling, but that was her experience. So you see this happen, and this can, this understanding can explain some of the variability in the presentation of the person and in their mood. However, this is not all that is there making up the mind of the individual. If we move on to the next slide, which is called One Narcissistic Object Relations Dyad Defending Against Another, here we get to a more complex picture of the mind. As in borderline personality disorder, in narcissistic personality disorder, there is an imagined ideal relationship that remains split off from the defensive grandiose versus devalued constellation. Because you see, that first constellation, the grandiosity of one person and the devalued state of the other really isn't, there's no love in that. There might be grandiosity, but there's no loving affect. And we feel that in people there with who are organized at a borderline level of personality, there's a split between the loving feelings and the aggressive, hostile feelings. So we feel in narcissistic people, as in borderline people, there's a kind of a hidden image of what a perfect ideal relationship would be. And we try to see some evidence of this, the longing for the ideal relationship that can emerge. And it can emerge in the course of therapy. If I'd been more tactful with the patient I mentioned, you know, maybe she would have stayed in the therapy. Maybe she would have let some of her vulnerability show through over time. I'll get more into that later. Moving on to the next slide, what we're aiming for is the normal organization of the personality. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is the neutralization and dismantling of the pathological grandiose self through the integration of the parts of the mind that up to then had been split off and extreme and unrealistic in their nature, were like caricatures making up the mind of the individual. So the image of the idealized caretaker relationship must be brought to light and understood along with the image of the grandiose self, because both of these images are extreme and not realistic. They don't correspond so much to the reality of the world. And our goal is the integration of these extremes into more nuanced and realistic images of self and other. So that you, it's like the concept most therapists have learned of being good enough. You're good enough, you're not perfect, but, you know, you have some flaws, you have some strong points, you have some love, you have some frustration. It all fits together. As I said earlier, though, this is complicated in the treatment of narcissistic individuals by the tenaciousness of the grandiose self and how it is very fragile, and how if it doesn't do its defensive job, the person can be flooded with humiliation, shame, inferiority, and so on. So what are the obstacles to treatment? And here I'm going to talk maybe for 10 more minutes, maybe less, and leave you time for some questions. The obstacles, I've already mentioned one, is the fragility. So in our kind of treatment, TFP, we start by framing the treatment. We set up a contract. We feel you can't do treatment unless the conditions of treatment are clear. If conditions of treatment are clear, you're kind of headed for trouble and confusion. So this goes well enough with most patients, but with a narcissistic patient, it can be a first challenge to their grandiosity. So even a simple thing like setting up a regular schedule, they might take as a challenge to, you know, who they are in the world. So I've had patients who said, well, yeah, I'm not going to set up a regular schedule with you because, you know, I just can't do that. And, you know, my schedule is too important to commit to being here a couple of times a week. So one of the modifications we make sometimes is to be more flexible and say, well, you know, okay, for a while we can sort of schedule from one session to a time. And usually over time the patient realizes you're just wasting time in session setting up the next one. So they agree to a regular schedule. But again, for the therapist out there, you have to be so careful about simple elements of reality that can challenge the person's grandiosity. Another thing that is an obstacle to treatment is what we call secondary gain. Secondary gain are kind of the fringe benefits that come along with having an illness. This can be a medical illness, you know. If I'm sick in bed with a flu, I get extra caring, you know, soup brought to me and so on and so forth, don't have to go to work. So, you know, that's fine. But sometimes the secondary gain or the fringe benefit of an illness can be a cause to perpetuate the illness. And there are a fair number of people with narcissistic personality disorder who are on either medical disability through social services or on what's the equivalent from the family who continues to pay for their life. The woman I evaluated at age 50 who was trying to get the job as a telemarketer was still having her life paid by her family. Now, the fact that these sort of things are in place are sometimes make it hard for the patient to get better, because getting better means giving up those ways of being taken care of. So you kind of have to work with the part of the patient that can see independence as autonomy is more valuable than getting taken care of in those ways. Also, one of the difficulties setting up the treatment, as is often the case with borderline patients, how to deal with self-destructiveness and suicidality. The narcissistic patient can be quite distressed and even suicidal when their defensive system breaks down. So without going into the details, you have to have a system of how to deal with those eventualities in as safe a way as possible. So moving on to the next slide, and we are getting to the end, and we'll have some time for questions. What are some of the technical aspects of treatment we recommend? How do we adapt the therapy to the particular type of pathology, in this case the narcissistic pathology? Now, I've just said how in the more fragile cases you might have to be more flexible, like even if something is concrete with the schedule. But in this slide, the first point is the more serious the case, the more strict and fully developed is the frame. Now, what I mean by the more serious case here is those people within the narcissistic spectrum who tend toward the antisocial. The more severe subset of narcissistic patients tend to have antisocial traits. There might be lying and cheating and misuse of credit cards and writing bad checks. And I've had a number of young adults come into my treatment who would have been in jail except their parents kept bailing them out. And you found out that there was a lot of dishonesty. Example, you know, a young man who had been getting a lot of money from his parents because he was, quotes, in college. Well, he actually wasn't in college. So the whole college story was a fabrication to be getting money to pay for the college expenses, which was going to, you know, alcohol, drugs, and gambling. So when I say a more strict and fully developed frame, in a case like this, you have to have another source of communication. It would be naive to say, we'll do a regular therapy, just me and the patient. We had to have a system where I had input from the parents on a monthly basis to make sure what the patient was saying was corresponding. I had to have a system where there was documentation from the school that the patient was actually enrolled and so on and so forth. I think you get the picture. Also, next point on this slide, the more serious the case, the more interpretations will address the primary nature of aggression versus the primary nature of libidinal or loving strivings. This is a complex item, but basically we see people organized at a borderline level of personality as having a struggle between their loving feelings and their angry, aggressive feelings. And in some people, they really, really, really want to get close to people, but they keep tripping themselves up because they're afraid. They have anxieties that other people will hurt them. Those are the higher-level borderline people. You have to interpret their anxiety about connecting, and then often it frees them up to connect. However, with the lower-level people, and especially the lower-level narcissists, sometimes there is a satisfaction in being aggressive and just expressing that. And it's better for those people to get to know that about themselves so they can control it and use it adaptively rather than have it spill out all over the place through acting out. So, moving on to the next to the last slide. The principal obstacle to treatment with narcissistic patients is really this is the point I've been trying to make all along. The alternative, at least in the short term, to the grandiose self is a sense of annihilation. I'm nothing, I'm worthless, you know, I'm zero. So this is why, as I said earlier, it's important to have an accurate diagnosis. When somebody comes in, if their defenses fail and they're in that state of I'm nothing, I'm worthless, they can look really depressed. So you have to find a way to gear your therapy so you don't challenge the defensive system all at once and you let a relationship grow so that they can begin to feel that maybe an actual connection with somebody might be more important than the grandiosity they fall back on. And that's going to... Oh, I'm sorry. I have actually a few more slides. There are four more slides. I lost track of the last page. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how a therapist might deal with this. First of all, there's a slide that says how interpretation can be tricky with narcissistic patients. Sometimes patients interpret or experience interpretation as an imposition of power. They reject it because they think it's a sign of the therapist's grandiosity and they would have to submit to the therapist if they accept the interpretation, and so on and so forth. I won't go into all the details, but the point here is if you're a therapist out there, you might want to consider, if you're a therapist who works with interpretation, you might want to consider what we describe in the next slide, which is therapist-centered interpretations. These are interpretations where you explore how the patient perceives you before you explore how they experience themselves. Let me give you an example. Patient came to therapy with me after multiple other therapies, often for depression, sometimes for bipolar, sometimes for borderline. I made the diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder. We start the treatment, and what one could expect happened, which was I get devalued. You know, we're a few weeks, month or two into the treatment, all I hear from one session to the next is, I don't know what this was all about. I was referred to you because you're supposed to be a specialist. You don't know anything. You're just like every other therapist in the world. I don't know how you guys get the nerve to charge the big bucks you charge. You do nothing. You do absolutely nothing. You're total charlatans. I'm giving you a mild version of what I was hearing in the sessions. Now, that's the devaluation I said you have to expect. Now, of course, you know, I take that in and I say, what is this? This is an externalization of how this poor young woman treats herself all the time, devalues herself. So my first line of interpretation was more traditional when I said, you know, you're really attacking me a lot, and that's okay, but it must be really hard to be yourself because you do this to me 2 hours a week, but you're sort of, in your own mind, I suspect you're doing that to yourself, and it makes it hard to be you to be subject to all that attack. Now, I thought that was a kind of a nice interpretation, but it was met by the same kind of devaluing of me. She said, that's just straight out of your books, and, you know, why don't you ever come up with anything interesting to say? So I didn't think it was a bad interpretation, but it wasn't received. So switching to what we call a therapist interpretation, the next time I got this barrage of devaluing, I simply said, it must be hard to have a therapist who has so many limitations. Because I'm trying to point out here that you don't have to be perfect to exist. I'm acknowledging flaws. I can't help her ideally. I can't do everything I wish to help her. But I can continue to exist without falling apart and crumbling. So if the person can get to know the imperfect, flawed self through seeing it in the therapist and then maybe bringing it back to seeing they might have that in themselves, we think that's a better trajectory towards improvement. So in the final two slides, as therapy progresses, the patient gradually experiences a conflict between this refuge into the grandiose self, which really isolates him or her from the world, and some awareness of reality, which is maybe more satisfying as the relationship with the therapist gets beyond the devaluing. The therapist becomes often a representative of reality, becomes a bridge to a real alternative to what was that exquisite isolation. I say exquisite isolation because it had a certain perfection to it, but very separate from the rest of the world. So the therapist, of course, has to have a very acute empathy for the pain and sense of humiliation involved in the process, even as the patient is devaluing him or her, and family members have no doubt experienced being devalued too. And finally, the last slide is how reflective functioning is important in working with narcissistic patients. In fact, reflective functioning is a concept that means the capacity to reflect on one's own mind and on the mind of others. Now, if this develops in narcissistic patients, it helps the patient see that the grandiose sense of self is just one mental state, one sense of self among others. And as you help the person increase their reflective functioning, they get to know the other states of being within themselves, and hopefully they can try to add it all up into a package that is more nuanced, more rich, more complex, and more in sync with the world outside of them. So I'm going to stop there and see if you have any comments or questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Yeomans. It was an excellent presentation.
Thank you.
We have several questions that we're going to take from the floor here.
Yes. Okay.
Go ahead.
Yes, we have some from the...
Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Yeoman. This is Cheryl Kempinski from Los Angeles.
Hi.
I'm rather curious, what would be some of the presenting complaints that these type of complex individuals would be presenting with that would motivate them to get into treatment?
Okay. Like I said, often it's depression. When the defenses fail and they don't get the response they expect, you know, say in their work setting if they do, or in applying for a job, or from other people, that is the most common. But often it's families who bring people in saying, my son, my daughter just won't function. We can't get them out of the house. We can't get them to do anything. And this is a presentation which is a little bit trickier, because in this scenario, the patient, him or herself, doesn't, at least on the surface, have any motivation for treatment. The patient is trying to protect their sense of grandiosity by not going to school, by not looking for a job, because sort of intuitively in themselves, they know that if they go out there, they're not going to feel as great as they want to feel. So we have a whole sort of group of people now where the families come in, and we have to work with the families to say, look, this isn't ideal, because ideally an individual coming for treatment should want it him or herself. But here, since the family is paying for the life, for the, you know, all the living expenses of the patient, we have to work with the family so that the individual doesn't just pathologically depend on them forever. This can involve really sort of very concrete work, like, okay, let's look at a budget. What is enough to supply your son or daughter so that they're not going to be living in the street, but not rewarding them so much that they can continue their isolation without sort of being in enough pain that they might want to do something to change? So you see, you've got the two sides, when the patient themselves is suffering or when the people around are suffering. Okay?
Dr. Yeomans, this is James Rosser again. I have a question relating to an old myth that I think circulates with people about narcissistic personalities.
Yeah.
Being that narcissistic personalities are not likely to attempt or commit suicide.
Well, that's a myth. You know, it's hard to get demographic data on narcissistic personality disorder, and it's really frustrating. There should be more studies done on narcissism, but it's hard to make as much of a case for it being a public health problem. And believe me, I know it's hard enough to do that with borderline personality disorder. We in the world of borderline personality disorder should get a lot more support and funding than we do. You know, that's a whole other topic, which I know NEABPD represents very fully. But there's a lot of slides on that we could go over, but you probably have them. But the long and the short of it is that if you try to do demographic surveys of narcissism, narcissistic patients tend not to answer the questions on the survey honestly, because they don't want to acknowledge things that make them look bad or look like they have a problem. So to get back to your question, James, you know, there's a myth that narcissistic patients don't commit suicide, but they can. I don't know the percentage, but they're the ones who are more likely to do it very abruptly. Borderline patients tend to, you know, I mean, they can do it abruptly too, but often, you know, it's a part of a discussion. It's something one knows. It's part of, you know, a dialogue. It's part of the discourse, if you will. But when there's a sudden crashing down of the grandiose self, there can be a very, very abrupt suicide attempt or, you know, completed suicide without much warning. And I'll just tell you one thing. In my own experience as a psychiatrist, the highest risk patients for suicide are when you have narcissistic personality in conjunction with a major axis 1 disorder, like bipolar or schizoaffective or schizophrenic. Because if you've got an axis 1 person who's got a relatively healthy personality, they can learn to live. It goes back to the self-esteem. You know, they can accept, I've got schizophrenia, that's a real burden in life, but, you know, I can adjust to that. If you've got narcissism and schizophrenia, the schizophrenia is such a narcissistic injury. I've seen many people with that combination just kill themselves.
Okay. We have a question that came in through email from one of our other listeners in the conference tonight. Are there any studies demonstrating gender differences with narcissistic personality disorder?
Not to my awareness. That doesn't mean there aren't, but as I said earlier, it's hard to do demographic studies of narcissism because of how narcissists fill out the questionnaires or don't. So I don't know that. I don't know of any gender differences.
Okay. And also from the Internet, a question that I also had, which is partly a question that I had. The question here is, what was the thinking behind the DSM-5 committee's initial intent to remove narcissistic personality disorder as an independent disorder?
Well, it's hard to ask me that question since in a million years I wouldn't have come up with that thought. So I know I should be better versed in what their thinking was, and I have read some things about that, but I didn't go over them before this. Partly it's because there is not as much research about narcissistic personality as there is about some of the other personality disorders. So the DSM-5 Committee on Personality Disorders wanted to focus on those disorders where there's more research to look at, which favored the research part of the psychiatry world over the clinical part, because all the clinicians were up in arms saying, you know, this is just not right. We have lots of narcissists in our practice. So I'd say the first thing they were thinking was, let's go where the research is, but I just don't think that was fair to our clinical population or our clinicians. And they were, if I remember correctly, because they've gone through different phases, they were going to keep it as an axis, so you could have one of the other personality disorders, and there would be kind of a rating of to what degree the person was or wasn't narcissistic within that other disorder. But that would really weaken the attention that this diagnostic category deserves in and of itself. So that's as far as I can answer that for the moment.
Frank, well, another question that's come in. What percent of people with borderline personality disorder do you think have narcissism?
Oh, let me just open my computer. We've just done a study on that. I hope I can find it because I don't remember it by heart. Now, we did a study here in the States, and our colleagues in Europe did a study, and I tell you, I don't want to, well, maybe I can find it here. In our study in the States, which is based on an N of something over 100, but I think it was 120 or so, about 15% of the people with BPD had a comorbid NPD. My own experience as a clinician is that some of the people in that study didn't get an official diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder, but probably had it anyway, again, because of the way people answer questions about narcissism. Now, I can't pull up the right slide right now. In Europe, they had about 104 patients, and I believe their percentage of narcissistic patients was higher than ours, which was 15-17%, I think. But, I wish I could find that for you. If you want to forward the question to me, I will look up the results and get back to you about that when I have the hard numbers in front of me.
Okay, last question. In terms of antisocial personality, how many of them do you think have narcissistic personality disorder?
How many people with antisocial?
What's the percentage or the overlap of those two diagnoses?
Well, yeah. That's a very important last question. So even though we're a minute over time, let's take the time. It depends on how you consider antisocial personality. In the DSM system, antisocial personality is defined largely by behaviors, antisocial behaviors. I'm going to contrast that with the diagnostic system we use, which has to do with personality structure, whereas to have a full-blown antisocial personality disorder, you really have no interest in connecting with other people for any reason except to use them, to exploit them to your own ends. So we're talking about two different diagnostic systems. In the DSM system, where antisocial is defined largely on behaviors, I would say a very large overlap between antisocial and narcissistic, large overlap. In the system where you consider it more in terms of how the person relates to others, and if they have any place in any tiny little corner of their heart where they really care about others. And if they don't, only then are they a full-blown antisocial personality disorder. In that system, the antisocial person is more a psychopath or a sociopath. And there, I don't know if you could say there's an overlap, because the psychopath or the sociopath is a different kettle of fish, I think. And I want to emphasize this to the audience, because every once in a while, luckily not too often, but unfortunately still sometimes, in one's life or in one's practice, you encounter somebody who has that kind of antisocial personality when they have any cord in their body that corresponds to liking or caring about or having, you know, true concern for another person. If you encounter somebody like that, you have to be very careful. A lot of well-intentioned therapists have been harmed by such people, as have, of course, the individuals in the person's life. And the reason I'm making this distinction is that somebody with antisocial personality, in that more strict sense of the word, really, you're not doing them a favor if you save them from involvement with the criminal justice system, because sometimes the efforts to be therapeutic backfire. Having said that, if you've got somebody who's involved in antisocial behaviors but still has a little touch of the milk and human kindness in them, you can approach them therapeutically. So I'm just saying to people, in that rare instance of somebody encountering somebody who's sociopathic, you have to be really careful.
Dr. Yeomans, thank you so much. We are fortunate to have your wisdom, your research, and your clinical experience today.
And we thank you, and we thank UCLA for joining us and underwriting most of this Family Connections training. We thank the Gunderson residents for supporting our calls. We thank the Personality Institute for joining us on this call. So thank you. We've joined a few institutions. And next week we even go further away. We have Andrew Chainin from Australia.
Oh, my goodness.
Speaking. So we look forward to that. Thank you again, Frank. And good
well,
night.
I'd like to thank you, Perry and James. It's great to hear your voice again. And I look forward to seeing you in New York, Perry.
Terrific. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah. Bye-bye.